BBC Six Music.
Won't to scratch my itch, sweet Annie Rich, and welcome me back to town.
I don't know if I'm playing with fire, if I'm doing the right thing or not. I think I am. When I say that long hairs, short hairs, people with overalls and people with their velvet gear on can all be in the same place at the same time for the same reason. And that turns me on.
Out with the truckers and the kickers and the cowboys.
Why are we talking about this guy who never had a top 10 record? This guy worked in mysterious ways.
You know, it's really hard to put your finger on it.
He had a charisma.
He was a visionary.
He had a magnetism that really drew people in.
He saw the wonderful prose and poetry that was inherent in the country music.
It's a story that is so extraordinary. It's something that might be in a movie, but you don't think of it actually happening in real life that way.
We all have our stories. Grams was, the more you understand it, the more compassion you have to have for him.
He did something to country music, but he changed it, and the guy never had a hit record, which is why we're talking about him.
And I saw
about a calico bonnet from Cheyenne to Tennessee.
He never sold many records. He was never a household name. Yet Gram Parsons helped spawn an entire musical movement. By fusing the distinct entities of country and rock, he birthed a new sound called Cosmic American Music. And today, his influence can be seen in acts as diverse as Ryan Adams and the Magic Numbers, Elvis Costello and Emmylou Harris.
In my hour of darkness, in my
but Parsons didn't live to see his dream of uniting long hairs, short hairs, and people with overalls. He was dead by the age of 26. Perhaps even more tragically, the manner of his death and the theft and burning of his corpse in the desert have become better known than the music he made.
That's the part that bothers me, his death becoming bigger than his music. There are people who will evoke his name, and they couldn't tell you maybe one song title, or they were not touched by his music, but they were titillated by the story of his life and death. People should know his music. That should be his legacy, not the way he died.
The truth of the matter is that my father was a bit of a renegade, and fortunately or unfortunately, a very mythical creature, and I think that mythical creatures tend to go out in mythical ways. And if he had been able to choose the way that things went down, I doubt that things would have gone down much differently.
I've often said that death is a great career move. Graham, in retrospect, his records didn't do well, but more people became familiar with him. So I think that's a double-edged sword there, and both sides are okay.
Well, I heard the news. That's good to rock it tonight.
Music was always part of Graham Parsons' life. His father loved to play old country records, and Graham took piano lessons from an early age. In 1956, his mother arranged for Graham to see Elvis Presley in concert at Waycross, Georgia, where the family lived. In an interview which has not been broadcast since 1973, Graham told Jan Donkers about that time.
On our local station, I get country music mixed with some rockabilly. I always listen to rock and roll and black gospel music. I like some of the country music, some of the early Ira Louvin, the Louvin Brothers stuff turned me on, and so I listened to this combination of rockabilly. It's where I first found out about Presley. I saw him when I was like, I must have been 7 or 8, and I went with a couple of twins who were Bobby Soxters. He was billed second to Little Jimmy Dickens on the Grand Ole Opry show. He came on, and the whole place just went bonkers, man. The chicks were falling down, and I said, well, geez, Rich. Like, in my mind, all penetrated my mind. And I just walked through Little Jimmy Dickens' dressing room, back into Elvis's and said, "Hello there, you're Elvis Presley. I'm a little kid who buys records. I think you're all right." Shook my hand and gave me an autograph, sent me out the door, made sure I was with the twins and stuff.
Unlike the typical impoverished beginnings of so many Dixie musicians, Graham, born Cecil Ingram Connor, arrived on November the 5th, 1946, into untold wealth. His mother, Avis, was part of the Snively clan, a family who owned huge citrus plantations in Winter Haven, Florida, and whose business was worth over $400 million US dollars in 1955. Graham's father was Coondog Connor, a decorated World War II fighter pilot and self-made man. Though Coondog successfully wooed the fair Avis, he was never accepted as an equal by the Snivelys. The family lived in Waycross, Georgia, so Coondog could manage the Snively box-making factory there.
Well, it said my life has been so free and easy.
My ancestry is very entrenched in deep Southern tradition.
Here's Polly Parsons, Graham's only daughter.
There was a lot of secrecy, there was a lot of alcoholism, there was a lot of long nights of drinking and a lot of sadness because they weren't good communicators. They weren't able to communicate their needs and wants. It was very much about keeping the surface looking good, even though what was bubbling underneath was extremely damaged and not healthy emotionally.
Graham was not overly attended to by his parents. Avis had a deep addiction to alcohol, and Coondog, chafing under the heels of his Snively in-laws, began a spiral into ever-deepening depression. Graham was sent to an exclusive private boarding school in Florida. There he met Luke Lewis, who would later go on to head up the Universal and Lost Highway record labels. Lewis paints a picture of young Graham that's very much at odds with how he's come to be remembered.
It might surprise people, because I don't know that he was, you know, athletic after he got grown, but when we were kids, I taught him how to surf, actually. He was really good at that, and he was a good football player. He could run really fast. He was a pretty well-rounded young guy. He was a good student, actually. Way into English literature and Scottish folk ballads at the time. He was, you know, what we would describe today, I think, as hip for the time. So there was a little bit of something that cut him apart from the pack, I think, in the way that he appeared. Generally, he was just a guy that could run with everybody, and he liked all the same kind of fun things that all the rest of us did, and liked the girls, and liked to sneak out of school and run around and go to the beach and do all those things that you do when you're that age and you're away from home.
On December the 22nd, 1958, Coondog dropped his family off at the Waycross train station for their trip to Winter Haven, Florida, and Christmas holidays at the Snively Mansion. The next day, Coondog shot himself. Graham was 12 years old. In years to come, Graham was reluctant to talk about his upbringing and often embellished the truth, but it was clear the impact his childhood had.
I think that Graham's songwriting was the only way that he was able to get out emotionally what he felt so deeply inside, and I think that that's what draws us to Graham Parsons as a musician, as a songwriter, as a storyteller.
Ian Dunlop, who was later to become one of Graham's closest friends, recalls talking to him about those difficult days.
A lot of it, of course, you know, you can't erase it. He couldn't erase the rejection of his natural father by his mother's family. Some of these terribly, terribly traumatic things in his impressionable young childhood. It takes a lot of age to get over that stuff.
Phil Kaufman, Graham's road manager in later years, has his own theories about Graham's selective memory.
If you talk to Graham, you get different versions of who his dad was. He always portrayed him as a poor old guitar-playing Coondog Connors guy. He wanted to have a poor background, somehow a bit of a poor background, to justify being a, you know, a redneck singer. How do you sing the white man's blues when you got a credit card in your wallet?
This fancy that I'm on has been going on too long. It's time we stop pretending things are real.
Avis soon met a New Orleans businessman named Bob Parsons, and they wed. Bob was less than a perfect stepfather, having a reputation as a philanderer and as something of a wheeler dealer. However, he did legally adopt Graham and his sister, little Avis. Thus, Cecil Ingram Connor became Graham Parsons.
I started out younger.
Smitten by the impact of Elvis Presley, Graham became involved with several teenage groups in Florida. John Cornell first played alongside Graham in The Legends.
I was at a band at the time called The Dynamics, and we were having a rehearsal that day. Graham came in to check out the hall, and we invited him to come and sit in with us that night. And then a few days later, I got a call from Graham asking if Gerald and I would be interested in joining a band with him and Jim Stafford. They had some jobs coming up, and it sounded good, so that's what happened.
Mother Avis, ever ready to indulge Graham materially, if not emotionally, hired a manager named Buddy Freeman to oversee Graham's career. It was at a hootenanny booked by Freeman on Valentine's Night 1964 that Graham first met the Shilohs. Paul Surratt recalls that day.
Well, he was judging a talent show that the Shilohs were playing, and he watched Joe and I when we did the rehearsal the night before. He said, I heard you guys sing a Journeyman song. And we said, yeah. So we're big Journeyman fans. And he goes, I love the Journeyman. Let's try that song together. So we all of a sudden we hit this harmony, and we were like, whoa, what is that all from? And the next night we played, he was the judge of the talent show. We won, and then he got up and sang a song with us.
Well, I may be right, and I may be wrong, but you know you're gonna miss me.
The Shilohs were good enough to be offered a spot on the hugely influential, nationally televised Ed Sullivan Show, but Freeman turned down the offer, thinking that the band were not ready. It was to be the first of many near misses with fame in Graham's career. Back in Winter Haven, Bob Parsons bought a nightclub for Graham and his musical pals. The boys converted it into a youth club called the Derry Down, installing themselves as the house band. John Cornell.
He'd opened up a folk club called the Derry Down here. It was a coffee house, and we visited quite a bit, and I remember him kind of making fun of me because I was playing country back then, you know, because he wasn't really into it at all at the time. But in 67 I ran into him, and by then he was interested in country music. He had a Roberts tape recorder. It was a reel-to-reel tape recorder. And he said, man, I got some stuff I want to play you. And on that reel, he had like Loretta Lynn, George Jones, and all these country artists. He said, I have this music I've discovered I want you to hear. You know, I just thought, that's interesting.
Time can pass and time can heal, but it don't ever pass the way I feel.
Graham had been expelled from Bowles Academy shortly after his father's suicide. He drifted through two other schools before Avis arranged for him to be readmitted to Bowles for his senior year. It was shortly before his graduation that Graham received a phone call telling him that his mother Avis had died of alcoholism. My name is Bob Harris, and you're listening to Grievous Angel, the Graham Parsons story. In the summer of 1964, the Shilohs travelled to New York City to play the Bleecker Street folk clubs, following in the footsteps of their heroes, the Journeymen. However, autumn came, and with it new beginnings for Graham. In spite of his fractured academic record, he was accepted into Harvard to study theology. His move to Boston spelled the end for the Shilohs. Graham soon discovered the clubs of Cambridge, Massachusetts, and he formed his first rock group, The Like, with Ian Dunlop.
I suppose, typical of the time, he was pretty much like a folk singer-songwriter. He had made some contacts in New York, got a little bit of interest in his songs, and he wanted to put them in more of a rock format. He was looking for some new people. It sounded like a great project, and that's how we got involved.
Given that he spent his days playing music and not attending classes, it came as no surprise to Graham when he was dismissed from Harvard after his first semester. By now, he was ready to move again, this time to the Bronx in New York. There, with guitarist John Nuys, drummer Mickey Gorvin, and bassist Ian Dunlop, he formed the International Submarine Band. It was the first overt attempt by Beatles-style longhairs to play rock music influenced by country and western.
And I heard that old jukebox to play a song about a truck-driving man.
We definitely must have had something that gave us a distinction or an identity or marked us out differently from other people. And it certainly was this injection of country. You know, everybody wanted to be Rolling Stones clones, didn't they? We got the first little record deal, and when nobody was paying too much attention, we managed to sneak on a country song on the B side of it.
Here's Graham again.
We recorded in the early 66 a couple of times for Columbia. And for Ascot, we had to do a couple of things on the A sides that were like, one was a thing for film, but on the other sides of both records were like, one was a Jerry Lee Lewis tune, the other was a song called Truck Driving Man. We were always trying to do hard rock or rhythm and blues and country music at the same time. Nobody understood it.
And
in the fall of 1966, Graham visited L.A., hanging out with Brandon DeWilder, the actor he had befriended in Cambridge the year before. Whilst there, Graham stumbled into a party at the Hollywood Hills home of David Crosby, guitarist and singer with the Byrds. There he met and romanced Crosby's girlfriend, Nancy Ross. Parsons returned to New York City and informed the sub-band it was time to move west. Following Graham's arrival in L.A. in February 1967, Nancy quickly became pregnant, giving birth in December to a little girl, Polly. Graham was 21 years old.
We know it's wrong to let this fire burn between us.
One of the many unanswered questions that are part of the Graham Parsons legend relates to the paternity of Polly Parsons, with some doubting whether Graham was actually her father. Here's Phil Kaufman.
There was a little groupie girl hanging out, and somebody knocked her up. Instead of pointing to the guy who did it, she pointed to the guy with the money and said, you know, the baby is yours. He denied paternity, and we went to court on it. He had been drinking pretty heavy, and we got to court. It was either, you know, hang around for the court or go have a beer. So he opted for the beer, and he went off, and he ended up with a kid.
Polly herself takes a more philosophical view.
Depending on who you talk to, the story changes quite a bit. When you talk to people that were there, because I have, they are steadfast against the fact that Graham was anything but a completely loving father and was very, very much a part of my life. However, it was not appropriate for him to becoming a father business-wise. So the spin in the camp was he was not going to embrace the fact publicly that he was a father. I'm fine with it either way. If it is, that's wonderful. If it's not, that's wonderful.
We'll sweep out the ashes in the morning.
By all accounts, Graham loved his new lifestyle in L.A., frequenting the area's country clubs and ordering clothes from Nudie's Rodeo Tailors. Here's Ian Dunlop.
Myself and the drummer at the time, Mickey Garvin, had started playing with Barry Tashin. That was the original Flying Burrito Brothers. We were just fed up, and we wanted to go back to what we just really loved, which is just playing music. And Graham used to come along to some of the gigs, and not Sunset Strip, not the showcase places. If you went further out, like into the valley, it was a lot more like out west. Hey, you know, it was being brave walking into those places. The way in was oftentimes they'd have a house band, and they'd always have guests, and you could get up and sing. Graham kept going back to some of these places, and probably it was a matter of like, oh yeah, it's him again, you know, and it's like, well, you know, he is singing country music. Oh yeah, that is a George Jones song. Oh yeah, that's great, fine, yeah.
Well, I used to be the kind of guy that didn't love a lot. I took all the love they offered me with these.
He was fearless, you know, either fearless or stupid. I mean, you show up at a real redneck bar, long hair and crushed velour trousers and you know, silk scarves around your neck. You know, it's almost as has a sign on your back that says, kick me, you know. But he got in there and he'd sing and got their attention. He got their respect by the time he left. If he wasn't beaten up, he got their respect.
Ian Dunlop and Mickey Galvin left the International Submarine Band, unhappy at the direction Graham was taking. He was keen to record.